This is the current federal tax developments for the week of December the 12th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by Nichols Patrick CPE and your State Society of CPAs. This week, we're going to take a look at the following issues that have come up. We're going to take a look at a case that deals with farm expenses that got deducted in two separate tax years, and the tax court didn't have a problem with this. We're going to also look at the attempt of a franchisee group to get a tax exemption and why they didn't end up with that exemption. We ended up this week with the release of the early copy of the payroll tax withholding tables for 2017. And finally, looks like we're going to get one new tax bill out of the end of this year, as we'll take a look at a change that Congress made to give some relief to a problem that some people have been dealing with for the last couple of years with reimbursement of private health insurance premiums. Congress has now said we'll let you do that in certain cases, and we'll talk about though where the strings are. We've got a few things coming up. Now, we're getting here toward the end of the CPE season, and that does mean that a lot of you now are finishing things up here in December. There is some CPE that's going to be coming up in January this year. I'm going to be doing a couple of sessions here in Arizona. First, on January the 9th, I'm going to be doing a full-day session on partnership and LLC taxation, advanced issues. So we'll talk about all the partnership issues, including a nice discussion of the partnership audit regime, you know, where we stand on that at the moment and where we might be standing on that next year. We actually have to start start tax years that are going to be under those new rules. And then on January 16th, we'll do a full day on advanced tax practice issues. Both of those are at the Arizona Society offices in Phoenix, and both will be webcast. So they run from 8 to 3:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. If you have any interest in those courses, you can contact the Arizona Society of CPAs. Now this week, I'm going to be actually doing a couple of sessions. I'm going to be doing the tax updates, Arizona tax updates, and federal tax updates here in Arizona. We also have Mark Patrick and Bob Gill. We are going to be doing courses in Ohio the following week, tax update and other courses. So we still have a few courses here in December that you can pick up. So if you're of interest, take a look. They're going to be nearby. Bob is going to be doing his courses in Cincinnati. Mark's going to be doing his courses in Dayton. So if you're in those areas, you can take a look and sign up as you wish. But let's go ahead and get started with our developments for this week. And first up, we have the case of the estate of Steve K. Backenmeyer et al. Versus Commissioner, 147 Tax Court Number 17, in a published decision issued on December the 8th. And this is an interesting case because it deals with a unique situation and the IRS's attempt to deny a deduction for certain farm materials on one of two returns because they ended up on both. Now, Steve was a cash basis farmer, and in 2010, he purchased seed, chemicals, and fertilizer and fuel. Now, he's on the cash basis. He deducts them in 2010, but he was planning to use them when he planted his crop in 2011. Well, it turns out Steve didn't end up planting a crop in 2011 because Steve passed away in March of 2011 before the planting took place. All the assets of Steve's estate went to his wife, and his wife, of course, under Section 1014, got a step up in basis on all the assets. So, and she began operating the farm. So when she used those same materials, the seed, the chemicals, fertilizer, and fuel in 2011, she claimed that as a deduction on the 2011 return. Both the 2010 and the 2011 returns were joint returns with Steve and his spouse. And both of them showed deductions for these same items. The IRS said, wait a minute, you know, they cried foul. How in the world can they deduct these same items twice on two consecutive years on the tax returns? And so the IRS said, well, the IRS got a little confused about whether they should have been denied on the 2010 return or the 2011 return. But they clearly felt they should have been denied on some return. But the tax court didn't agree. The IRS said, wait, it's a tax benefit rule. And so, due to the tax benefit rule, when Steve actually didn't use that to plant a crop because Steve died, in essence, we should have had to recapture that and pick that up as income. But the tax court said, no, we don't agree with that. The court said the actual case they looked at in detail is United States Supreme Court case from 1983, the Bliss Dairy case. And the Bliss Dairy case originally dealt with a closely held corporation, cash basis of accounting, operated a dairy. Toward the end of the taxable year, it purchased the full, it paid for the full cost of cattle feed bought for use in its operation. Following the beginning of the next year, it liquidated the corporation and, you know, essentially, and distributed its assets to the shareholders in what was at the time a non-taxable transaction. In essence, this goes back to before General Utilities repealed the 86 Tax Act. The shareholders then continued operating the business, and they deducted their basis and the feed as an expense of doing business. In that case, the Supreme Court held liquidation of the corporation resulted in a conversion of the cattle feed from business to non-business use, which was an action inconsistent and therefore had to recapture the deduction. The IRS said, well, this is really the same thing. You know, Steve died. That was a conversion of the assets, you know, conversion of those assets that were going to be used in business to a non-business use. Just like Bliss Dairy, we should have to pick that up as income. And then his spouse could go ahead and deduct it in the following year. But the tax court didn't agree. The tax court said no. There's a key difference here. In the Bliss Dairy case, we were dealing with the pre-General Utilities rule that there'd be no gain or loss on the disposition of the asset. And when the asset came out, it would come out at fair value to the shareholders. That was the old rule under General Utilities. That was the old rule before we had the 86 Tax Act, where we'd have to recognize that gain inside the corporation. So they said, well, that's radically different. They said, in this case, Steve dies. Those assets would have been assets of Steve's estate. When Steve's estate, therefore, it goes into Steve's taxable estate. It's subject to estate tax. And then, under the rules that we have here in Section 1014, that gets a step up in basis to whoever receives them. So in reality, because it was subject to an interim tax, that's very different from what we had when the Bliss Dairy case. So because of that, there's no need to recapture. Now, we should point out that as a practical matter, two things are true about this that meant there never was going to be a tax paid. Number one, when Steve died, first thing is, it's very possible his estate was less than $5+ million that would have been subject to estate tax in that year. But secondly, even if his estate was worth $50 million, he was passing the asset to his spouse, which meant there'd be no estate tax imposed. That did not bother the court. That was not even really discussed by the court. Rather, the court said that it's perfectly okay for Steve's surviving spouse to claim that same deduction the following year that had been claimed on the prior. And in fact, because it was a joint return, she had been part of both returns. That's not relevant. As a published case, it said, look, this is unique. And kind of, as Steve's wife said, it wasn't as if this was some elaborate tax planning regime. Dying is a rather extreme step to take to save taxes. So because of that, they said it's an unusual situation, but it's perfectly okay for the deduction to end up being on both returns. Next up, we have an attempt to get a 501c6 status for a group of franchisees. This was a request for a ruling that this organization would qualify as a 501c6 organization. In this case, it was essentially a group of franchisees that were franchised by the same organization. Their exempt purpose was described as educating and helping franchisee members with the franchisor's current policies and new policies, communicating and finding resolution of these franchisees' issues to the franchisor executives, presenting and communicating the unresolved and disputed issues of franchisees to the president group, and hosting trade shows with vendors for the benefits of the franchisees and vendors. It provides the franchisees the opportunity to build one-to-one relationships with the vendors and vice versa. The organization said, well, you know, we're really a business league. And under C6, we should qualify for that. C6 says it gives an exemption to business leagues, chambers of commerce, real estate boards, boards of trades, and professional football leagues. not organized for profit, no part of the net earnings of which inures to the benefit of any private shareholder or individual. Well, the IRS said, guys, we don't think you meet this qualification. A business league is supposed to have a broadly general interest, but you're too focused. And the IRS went back and they cited a number of old rulings, which goes to Revenue Ruling 58394, which went back and said we had association of licensed dealers in a certain type of patented product. They ruled that was too narrow, didn't qualify. They also have noted that the National Mufflers Dealers Association case from Supreme Court in 1979 held an organization of muffler dealers franchised by Midas International Corporation did not qualify for an exemption from federal tax as a business league because it was too narrow to satisfy the line of business test. And of course, the practical answer is they're saying, well, you're just like the group of muffler franchisees in the Midas case. You know, the National Muffler Dealer Association, that, you know, just like that, you're basically franchisees of one franchisor. The IRS's position is, had we had a generally broad organization that, let's say, was, and this happened to be a set of, we found out if you read the ruling, it was a set of convenience store operators. Had it been a league of convenience store operators in general, conceivably, it would have been fine. But the fact that it was convenience stores operators of a single franchisee, we're not sure which one. Let's say it was 7-Eleven franchisees. That's too narrow a group. Now, the organization did come back and said, okay, we're going to open up our membership to other franchises. But the IRS said, well, you didn't really describe how you're going to serve those other entities, because all of your stuff is geared toward helping it with, you know, being a, let's say, 7-Eleven franchisee. That really isn't going to be much use to deal with 7-Eleven problems if you're franchised by a different franchisor. You know, it's not really important to you. And they never showed how they'd interact with anything else. So essentially, this group was denied the exemption. That's an important thing to remember, of course, is that a C6 does have to broadly qualify. Next up, a little piece of news for you. This is Notice 1036 issued on December the 5th, 2016. We ended up with an early release copy of the 2017 withholding schedules are now available. So if you're involved in your organization with doing payroll and you're involved, let's say, with updating your computer systems to compute payroll checks come January, now we have access to the information for doing that for next year. This document, which is normally issued by the IRS in December of each year, is a very simple 3-page document. A copy of it can be found in the PDF you can download from our website with this week's information. But it pretty much just gives you the information you need to be able to program your computer to run those payrolls that you'll be paying after January of next year. Now, this is not the full Circular E. In fact, these tables will be incorporated eventually in the full Circular E that will be published later. So if you're waiting for those more detailed tables, the lookup style tables, then yeah, that's going to be in the Schedule E that will be published later. That'll come up on the IRS website. But if you're using the percentage withholding method, and I suspect a lot of us are using that these days because of computer systems, this will be the set of tables you'd be looking for if you have to update those yourself. And these are the set of tables that your vendor is looking for if they're going to be sending you an update. So essentially, the nice thing to know is those tables are there. And also, if you want to kind of run some numbers about where a payroll check will look for next year, you obviously could use these to go ahead and manually run those numbers up. So they are available. So you want to make sure, and if you need them, to go ahead and take a look and pick up what you need from the percentage method withholding tables. Well, interesting enough, it's the end of the year, and we're getting a new tax law. But unlike prior end-of-the-year tax laws, where we're looking at all these extenders, no, we're not getting extenders. So if you're thinking, I'm just going to tell you that we're going to be getting extenders, so all those things that are dying at the end of this year will somehow get a new lease on life. No, that's not happening. We're also not getting, almost certainly before the end of the year, actually, we know pretty much for sure at this point we're not, because I doubt Congress is going to show back up again to pass this. We're not getting the technical corrections bill either, which, by the way, an important part of that is going to have a number of things with the partnership exam rules. That's going to be picked up again when Congress comes back next January, the new Congress comes in. But we did get the 21st Century Cures Act, which is H.R. 34. It was passed by the Senate on December the 7th. It is not yet, as of this recording date, I have not yet seen that it has been signed by the president, but the president has indicated that he plans to sign this bill. The very last portion of this bill, most of this bill does not deal with tax matters, but the very last section of the bill, Act Section 18001, does deal with a significant tax matter for many of us. You may remember back in Notice 2013-54, the IRS announced effectively that if a private company, that if basically, if an employer reimbursed the insurance premiums of an individual, right, there was a private insurance policy. So let's say, as sometimes happened with small companies, you discover that your group policy would have a premium that was way above what your employees could get by buying private insurance, that you would just agree to reimburse their private policies. The IRS in Notice 2013-54 told us that that would violate the Affordable Care Act's rules, two different rules on basically the market reforms. The more significant is that you had a limitation on life on benefits, either annually or lifetime. And the IRS position was you could not integrate your payment of the premiums with the benefit offered by the policy to show you had no lifetime limits. That would trip you with a $100 per day penalty for each employee that was affected, which made it rather expensive, shall we say, to do this. Well, Congress has now decided that we are going to allow certain small companies to go ahead and do this. We're going to exempt them from the $100 a day penalty. But there are a number of strings attached, so it's important to understand what this is going to do. First thing is, this will be effective for years beginning on or after January 1st of 2017, or technically it says years beginning after December 31st of 16. So the practical answer is it's effective in January. Prior to January, the law provides that instead, Treasury Notice 2015-17 will be treated as applying to any plan year beginning on or before December 31st, 2016. Now, unfortunately, the law is not terribly clear about what they meant by that, but presumably what they meant was that relief that supposedly expired in June of last year for the $100 a day penalty, they're going to treat that all the way through. So they're going to basically give you a pass no matter what you're doing through the end of this year, because that's what that old notice 2015-17 gave you a pass through June of 15. Well, so apparently we're going to get that pass all the way through the end of this year. No $100 a day penalty, no matter what your company has been doing. However, beginning this year, beginning in 17, you're only going to get an out if your program meets a number of criteria. The first important criteria is you cannot be an applicable large employer under the Affordable Care Act. If you're an Apple large employer, you can't qualify for this relief. So, you know, basically, if you're subject to the penalty for failing to provide affordable insurance coverage to your employees, then you can't use this method. Let's assume you're not an ALE. Then a few things are required. Number one, the arrangement has to be funded solely by the employer and cannot be funded by salary reduction arrangements by employees. Secondly, after an employee provides proofs of coverage, the employer can reimburse expenses of medical care, which obviously seems to include the medical insurance, and the amounts of payments and reimbursements for any year cannot exceed $4,950. Or if it's family coverage, $10,000. This will be indexed for inflation. Now, there are some now, the other catch is you have to offer it to all eligible employees, on effectively the same basis. There is a limited amount of variation allowed where essentially it'll still be treated on the same term, even if you have differences in the premiums or offerings that due to ages, you know, age imposed things in these, or the number of family members that each person have will also not be treated as offering on a different basis to each employee. If an employee is not with you for the whole year, the dollar limits are prorated based on the number of months they're there. Now, the important issue about eligible employees, again, this is something that is now going to be required. You've got to offer to all eligible employees. And we're going to borrow the requirements under 105H3B for self-insured medical reimbursement arrangements. Except instead of having a 3-year waiting period, we'll have a maximum 90-day waiting period. So that means you need to cover all of your employees except those who have not completed 90 days of service, employees that have not attained age 25, part-time or seasonal employees under the definition we have under 105 for what those two things mean, any employees who are covered by a collective bargaining agreement where medical coverage was part of the agreement, or any non-resident alien employees. Part-time and seasonal, the general rule we have there still applies. Part-time, generally, you have to work less than 7 months a year, or should be seasonal, less than 7 months a year, to be part-time, less than 25 hours a week. But there is an exception where it can grow to 35 hours if no other employee in your organization does the same work. Or if you have other employees in your organization that do the same work and work more hours, or you don't have other employees in your organization that do the same work, but other employers in your area have employees that do the same work and work more hours. Generally, the employees, now here's the other catch, the employees will not be able to go get a subsidy from the exchange because this is going to be considered an offer of affordable coverage so long as the excess of what would be paid by the employees a premium for each month for self-only coverage on the second lowest silver cost plan, essentially is less than 9.5% of their household income. These are all measured on a monthly basis, so you divide that down by 12. So effectively, this is going to be an offer of affordable coverage for the most part, as long as what they have to pay is below that level. That means what you cannot do is send your employees to the exchange, have them get subsidized coverage, and then reimburse subsidized coverage. You do have to give a statement to employees about this. You have to tell everybody, what would be your permitted benefit under the arrangement for the year, how they provide information, what they have to tell the exchange about they have an offering under this program. And, if you're not covered on any minimal essential coverage for any month, the employee may be subject to a tax under the Affordable Care Act for not having the coverage. If you fail to give that notice, the penalty is $50 per incident. Now, that notice, of course, has to come out relatively quickly. We'll see if the IRS can give us some limited relief on that, because technically we should get those notices out effectively right away at the beginning of next year. That may be a problem. Now, remember, key difference here, though. Unlike what you've done before, it's got to be offered to everybody. There's very limited exclusions to get covered by this. And number two, we have a cap on what can be offered. That $49.50 may prove to be a problem depending upon the cost of insurance that's going to be available under those individual policies for the different employees. So be very careful. Or $10,000 for a family coverage, remember. But it does mean that if you meet these requirements, you'll now be able to escape the $100 penalty. Flip side of that is, if your client does not want to set their system up to meet all of these requirements under this rule, then I think it's going to be pretty obvious. Your choice is either to drop all coverage or to go find a group plan, because that's the only way you could do it. Note, this is also backdoor. We've talked about the fact that effectively the IRS Department of Labor have put off to the side the no discrimination provision in the Affordable Care Act. It's simply not currently being enforced. There's no current penalty because there's no current definition of what discrimination is. But this particular law clearly puts a non-discrimination clause in. It makes it very clear how it's to be defined. So if you're going under this program, you can't just say, I'm only going to cover these five people. While in theory, if your group plan allowed you to do that, you could do that under the current rules. You can't do that under this structure. So have a discussion with your clients about whether or not this is something they want to do. Could be an interesting problem and could be an interesting decision. Oh, by the way, you've only got a couple of weeks to make this decision. Well, we're here now, of course. We're getting to the end of our CPE season. So on behalf of Nichols Patrick and your state societies of CPA, we want you to go ahead and take this time to relax, enjoy the pre-tax season, holiday time of year. as we get here. A whole bunch of us just kind of kick back now the last 2 weeks of December. You can enjoy that and probably maybe the first week and a half in January, and then everything gets started. I'm sure we are going to keep yourself a bit busy here the last few days of the month with some tax planning work for clients, so be ready for that. But take care, enjoy yourself, and you know, and kind of take it easy, because unfortunately, tax season is coming. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of December 12th of 2016. Remember, you can check our updates when we write them up on this website, currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. That's also where you can find a PDF with articles for today's information that we talked about in today's session. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, or you can follow me on Twitter. It would be @edzollers. We look forward to basically seeing you in the few remaining courses we have to do this year if you want to come out and see us. Otherwise, be sure to come back next week. We'll talk about whatever the IRS and the courts come up with during the week, because Congress is kind of gone. But we'll take care of these other things. And you know, watch your way here as we come up to the close of the year and get ready to start the new year talking about what's happening in the area of federal taxes.